Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. I'm Terry Foy, joined once again by Nick Osello. And once again, we are recording during a game. Because of the lightning delay, we are watching North Carolina up 5-4 on Duke with 9 seconds left in the first quarter. We got, let's see, looks like a Jacob Kelly, end line restart, crossfield skip pass, and Mike Adler does not win the race to the end line, but there's 1 second left, so I don't think Carolina's going to do anything here. We will provide updates as the game unfolds, but we just couldn't wait any longer. We are here to talk about the most important thing in the lacrosse world. Jared Bernhardt signed an undrafted free agent contract with the Atlanta Falcons, becoming the first player ever to play college lacrosse and then play in the NFL. Congratulations, Jared. Congratulations to the entire Bernhardt family. I'm sure that there was no nepotism involved. That's a joke. Nick, what do you have to say about this historic moment?
Oh, man, so much. So, first off, no one has ever played college lacrosse and then gone on to play in the NFL. Truly a feat. And shout out for, you know, Jared to overcome, you know, bad genetics. Nobody in his family has accomplished anything athletic other than him. So for him to just kind of break out of this mold, I think his entire family is accountants, actually. For him to just overcome so many odds and finally make it to an NFL roster, you know, what's harder to play in, the Fiesta Bowl or the NFL? I'm not here to debate that. I'm just here to congratulate him. And Terry, also congratulate you on a former colleague of mine, Kyle Hamilton, who I believed you wanted to see go to the Ravens. And now I'm stuck in this horrible, horrible reality where guys that I want to see succeed are on a team with worse fan base than the Philadelphia Eagles, worse fan base than anyone else you can think of, the goddamn Baltimore Ravens.
Were you in the defensive back room with Kyle Hamilton?
No, I was too old. He was
did you host him on his like official visit?
No, I wasn't allowed to be around much. They were like, all right, you're going to be the walk-on. Let us know when you're going to go ram CTE through the, you know, front wall. Otherwise, shut your mouth. It's like that rock, know your role and shut your mouth. And I was like, hell yeah, I'm just happy to be here, brother.
All right, Nick, we are actually going to talk about lacrosse. Last week, I said that the best-case scenario for you and your ACC brethren was Michigan beating Ohio State and Harvard and Cornell missing the Ivy League tournament. You only got one of those three things. Harvard, having lost to Yale in overtime, is now, in my opinion, on a one-team bubble that they share with Notre Dame, Duke, and maybe Carolina if they can beat Duke, in which case that would eliminate Duke probably from being on that bubble. So, yeah, let's talk about how we got here.
First off, I love that, you know, the best case scenario includes Michigan beating Ohio State, because I gave that about a 0% chance of happening. But hey, wishful thinking, the Big Ten is a tragedy. What I really don't like is the biases combining, meaning of all the teams that I wish I had to cheer against, Harvard is the very last one of them. The two teams that I care about most that I have relationships with are Harvard and Notre Dame. And now I have to root pretty much, I mean, we'll see how kind of everything shakes out, but I have to root against them not making the playoffs so that Notre Dame makes it. I mean, if Notre Dame slaps Duke, is there a way for Notre Dame and Harvard to be in the playoffs, given what's going to happen in the Ivy League tournament? Do we have to just start going down like scenario rabbit holes?
I don't think that. To me, it's just Ohio State. Like, that's the only team that they could potentially. I mean, so Princeton and Harvard missed the Ivy League tournament. Penn, Yale, correct, Cornell, and Brown got it.
You mean, oh yeah, Princeton missed. Okay, yeah. Yeah, because everyone was like, we won the Ivy League, which I'll go on that rant in a second after you finish your thought.
So my opinion is that those four teams who made the tournament are safe. Obviously, one of them is going to get the AQ, and then the other three who are already top eight or nine in RPI are only going to enhance their resumes. So the two teams that are idle, Princeton is number two in RPI. They're not missing the NCAA tournament. So, I mean, I guess there's a scenario in which everything that is not Ivy League related could go terribly for Ohio State's resume, and maybe their RPI could sink a little bit. And if they get blown out by Rutgers in the Big Ten semifinal and the eye test comes into play, could they potentially not make it? And as a result, Harvard gets that spot. Ohio State beat Harvard. I should take this moment to underscore Ohio State also beat Notre Dame. So I struggle to see that.
I thought Ohio State played Rutgers. They have one regular season game against Rutgers, right?
And it did not go well for the Buckeyes.
Yeah. Or no, like this upcoming one. And
no, this is the Big Ten semifinals.
Or is that already the... I couldn't remember if there was like one last like weird midweek game.
One last
game.
Hurrah.
Yeah.
There should be.
All right. So they have one chance to blow it. But again, with wins over Harvard and Notre Dame, I feel like that's going to be a tough pitch to put them out and Notre Dame and Harvard in. Terry, honestly, things aren't looking good. What even am I rooting for?
I mean, you're rooting for us to get quickly through the next 10 minutes of podcast so that you can talk about what we saw on Sunday afternoon in the Carrier Dome. But let's stick to the rundown, because otherwise I'm going to get all out of whack.
Okay, perfect.
Yale 17, Harvard 16 in overtime. One of the best games I've seen all season long. Thomas Bragg ended it with an aptly described piss missile from the top middle on extra man with about 2 minutes to go in the extra frame. I talked to Jerry Byrne postgame, and I thought he put this what dictated the outcome, basically like how the game unfolded, pretty succinctly. He said, they're a good slide and recover offense. We consider ourselves to be a pretty good slide and recover defense. They played better slide and recover offense than we did defense. So he clearly attributed the outcome to the fact that they gave up 17 goals. The Crimson got yeoman's effort, an effort that I could imagine you would be proud of, from Steven Cucurullo and Kyle Massimilian at the faceoff X. I believe they combined to go like 13 for 39 or something like that. And yet, I believe that Harvard only suffered a -2 or -3 possession disadvantage over the course of the game, and they really dominated possession in the second half. So they fell behind early. This was a game in runs through the first half, and then they scored 5 out of 6, wrapping around the end of the third into the fourth quarter, took a 14-12 lead, and then it was a Nick Ramsey fast break goal off the faceoff. Then he took a push on the subsequent faceoff, and it set up a Chris Lyons goal. He finished with 5. About 50 seconds later, all of a sudden, it was a 14-14 game. And then it was just nip and tuck from that point forward. You know, each team got 2 goals. Harvard hit a pipe that would have put him up 2. That was kind of a wind out of your sails type of moment. And then Leo Johnson scored the game tying goal with about 2 minutes to go that set up that overtime game winner on extra man. That was the function of a hold call that I don't think anybody had an issue with. It was, you know, definitely a penalty. So we don't have to get too uppity there, but an incredible showing from the Crimson. You know, I had a feeling that they were going to be able to score. I didn't know that they were going to get to 16, particularly without having a dominant day facing off. So they have a lot to be proud of, and they're going to keep practicing. You know, they're going to find out their fate and whether or not they've got first round NCAA tournament game almost exactly 7 days from right now. But you got to hold out hope. You never know.
Yeah, I mean, first off, I think you said it. This was the first game in a while. Granted, full disclosure, you know, my boss went to Yale, pretty involved with the program, I would say. And then I was rooting for Harvard still. It almost
didn't
matter.
Did you tell him that?
No. And I hope he's not listening. If he is, sorry, what a prank. I'm literally so funny. but this was one of those games where I haven't seen one of these games in a while. You just kind of got to sit back and just throw your hands up at every goal and just go, oh my God, like, of course this is happening. This game is unbelievable. This is the best game from a pure entertainment standpoint that I've watched in a long, long time. And I actually have some pretty good insight for this game because looking back at the way that Coach Byrne like prepares for games and things like that, I think, of course, like 98% of it, I always end up going to like, well, of course, that's the way that things are. And I think that that's exactly what needs to be done. What I want to see more out of Harvard's defense, whether or not it happens the rest of the year, if they make the playoffs or like implemented next year, it is a matchup and to an extent, like almost player neutral system where it's like, okay, we don't really care who is on the ball. We know the player's tendencies, but the player's tendencies don't overpower the strength of our system in general. And I think that college lacrosse is changing a little bit because, you know, players objectively are smarter than I was in college, and they have the room in their heads to know like the top four or five threats on each team. And gotta say, like, Bragg shooting from top center men up is something that you would rather make one of those top left or top right guys on the man up beat you with his vision or his shot as opposed to Bragg from top center. So it was interesting to see whether it was a matter of Harvard execution or, you know, just Coach Byrne's approach to defense, not have that be like the number one threat, because the game in points was pretty sloppy. And it was like, shit, if you feed the crease, that's probably going to be a turnover. We're going to be able to collapse. And I didn't see vision that could have picked apart something that would be more dangerous than Brad's shot.
So I've got a lot to say about that. The first is, you described what Jerry has said is his philosophy for 15 years, which is everybody is matchup conscious. We are not. We prepare a six-man unit such that everybody can cover anybody if you get switched on to it. So we are not going to be overly cognizant about picks. We're not going to, you know, try to get under on this one, try to get over on that one, switch this one. So, you know, we're going to let you basically try to work for the matchup that you want to get, and then we're going to be really cognizant about how to support our own personnel. And in talking about the threat that a 17-yard shot represents on extra man after the game, he said that is a shot that we are comfortable giving up. You got, like, you can't stop everything, so you got to pick the things that you're going to be comfortable with giving up, and that's one of them. And one of the things that's really interesting about that is I wonder how he's come to the decisions as to which are the acceptable threats and which are the ones that aren't. Because when I talk math with him and get, like, super, like, actual stats and analytics, he kind of like recoils. He's like, it's not really my thing. So then you kind of wonder, it's like, all right, well, are you doing the mathematical analysis when it comes to identifying the threats? Or are you basing it off of your own judgment, right? Your own eye test. And that's the part that I'm like interested in terms of how it continues to evolve with him and this staff.
Well, and it's, you know, I'm starting to become firmly on the side, especially seeing things like, you know, way more exposure to NLL since graduation, way more exposure to pros. Like, I think that there are certain aspects of college lacrosse that are more lethal, that I would put a premium on taking away. And I think there's actually a little bit of gray area and a little room. It's like, yes, I know your system first, but does your system dictate, like, hey, if this player is strictly right-handed from X, let him beat you and shoot a left-handed shot running up the hash marks, because that's more dangerous than the potential of a rollback. Like, be more worried about the rollback than him with his left hand in front of the cage, things like that. And so, you know, it's always this gray area, teeter totter type of situation. But I mean, I just thought that within Coach Burns' system, there is room for go out and get pressure on his hands top center. Because that's the number one threat, and that's more difficult. Like, you want to make the offense make as many passes to score as possible, and a step down shot is a lethal step down shot is one of the easiest things to take away. So, you know, if that's a shot that he's okay, well, then we just have a, you know, a disagreement maybe in, you know, how we approach what are the biggest threats. But I was just surprised to see that. Honestly, I was. So maybe it was just a stretch too thin on a man down. And, you know, we're kind of hyper-focusing on one play, which I think doesn't give credit to how good, you know, Harvard's defense looked in moments. But that's my rant, is if I were the head coach of a program, I would lean more towards taking away specific threats than relying too much on the system.
So, continuing on with this game, one of the things that needs to be shouted out is Joe Dowling, a freshman middie for Harvard who broke his finger early in the season and made his debut against Cornell. So, he was playing in his fourth game, and he had only scored one goal coming in, and he had 3-1, including, I can't recall whether it was the 16th or 15th goal. I think it was the 16th goal that put Harvard ahead. And I think he was an emblem or a symbol for the takeaway from this game, if you're a Harvard fan, is we had 17 of 23 contributors that were freshmen that have 3 years of eligibility left after this year. And for me, you look at Sam King, you look at the close defenders down low, and that's all well and good. Those guys are really good, but I would argue that that doesn't look that different from past Harvard teams that didn't attain the level of success that this program is currently aspiring to. But when you look at Owen Gaffney, Joe Dowling, some of the other freshman midfielders whose names are currently escaping me right now, and I will reference when you start talking, that athleticism, toughness, and creativity or creation with the ball in their stick is just tremendous. And not only that, but also a lot of these guys are playing midfield, but they can also play attack. So as Austin Madronic and Hayden Sheik graduate and create role opportunities down low, there's going to be talent that can move down, and they're going to have experience, right? You're not going to be relying on new starters in order to fit in. So, you know, my sense is that the Harvard group, disappointed with the outcome, no doubt about it, don't know what the future holds relative to the 2022 season. But regardless of what happens, going to take a lot of solace and a lot of pride in the fact that the game they played against Yale put Yale, who is, in my opinion, and I think a lot of people's opinion, been the class of the Ivy League for at least the last 5 years, on notice that their chief rival is going to bring the fight to them in ways that they haven't over the course of the last 5 years.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think, of course, it's representative of a number of things. But it was one of those curious things where it's like, why Harvard, literally one of the best schools in the country, couldn't field the good lacrosse team? It never made sense. And so to know, you know, I'll even give a shout out to Will Corrigan, who's a very good friend of mine, but it's almost tough to get a hold of Will in the spring or in the summer. It's like, hey man, we're trying to think of getting together for a whatever weekend. What are you thinking? And he's like, dude, Jerry has my nose to the goddamn grindstone. I'll talk to you in mid August. And I think that, you know, the youth core that they have is going to be representative of a lot of talented classes that they're going to be having moving forward. And if I'm buying a stock in the Ivy League, it would be Harvard, because they've been not great. What was that stat where it was like they've like three Ivy League championships in like the last 40 years? Or like, do you remember that one that was going around Twitter?
I missed that one. And I will say that, like, my opinion of Harvard, I think they've made the NCAA tournament three times since 2007. And
maybe that was a stat.
Well, but like that's
I was close.
That's not a good number, but it I think exceeds their reputation. I think that in people's minds the program has been worse than it's actually been. They've been, generally speaking, a 500 team that has spiked up to being an NCAA tournament participant. The problem is they've gotten a handful of top five recruits and top five recruiting classes. And again, well, I don't know. You and I haven't spoken about this on this podcast. I've spoken about it dozens of times over the course of the last 15 years.
Okay.
Recruiting rankings are not... they're not objective. They're not provable. They're not right or wrong. So if a player doesn't turn out in college, it is to an extent a condemnation of the ranking, but the ranking is also largely informed by the demand for that player. So the notion that Harvard's coaches are bad talent evaluators and the fact that they want a guy should be an indicator of the fact that he's not worthy of being a top five recruit because the other top five recruits that they've gotten have come and haven't turned into multi-time All-Americans. Well, tell that to the Georgetown, Yale, Duke, and Denver staffs who are also recruiting him, or Notre Dame. You know what I mean? It doesn't make sense. So anyway, yeah, being a top five recruit is a combination of how good of a player you are right now, how good of a player you project to be, and how in demand you are by the aggregate of great college coaches and programs. So anyway, that's my whole thing about Harvard. Shout out to Miles Bacchus, Andrew Perry, Andrew O'Berry, a handful of other guys that Andrew G. Gennaro that were really good, Ray Durth, that were really good all year, Lucas Hilsenrath. So the future is bright for the Crimson.
Yeah, I'm pissed that when I was at Air Force, I remember recruiting Miles Bacchus for a little bit. But the fact that he didn't go there, you know, we'll talk, Miles.
Moving along. Cornell 18, Princeton 15. The Big Red came out with, "It's great to be here," on the back of their t-shirts. The saying ascribed to their legendary coach, Richie Moran, who died last Sunday at 85 years old. They used the momentum born of that to jump out to, I believe, a 12-5 lead before Princeton fought back, made it either a one-goal game, I want to say. I think this might have gotten to 14-13, somewhere in that neighborhood, before the Big Red pulled away down the stretch. And for me, you know, we talked about how this game yields the Tigers missing the Ivy League tournament. And even though they're 3-3 and certainly had a great year and are in the midst of a great year, their defense has really regressed after being a strength in the first 6, 7, 8 games of the year. And on the flip side, Cornell, who I think, you know, also got off to an incredible start, but has been a little bit rockier. And even in some of their wins, like the overtime win over Syracuse that everybody watched because it was the only game happening on a Monday night, they didn't look great. I've talked and written extensively about how this is a team that is figuring out how to play without their best midfielder in Aiden Blake. And little by little, it feels like they're figuring out a little bit more. And in this game, it was Michael Long, 3 goals and 4 assists, his most productive game recently, and John Piatelli, who is just an awesome goal scorer, 5 goals and an assist. So, you know, at the other end of the field, Gavin Adler, there are a lot of people talking about him rightfully as a Schmeisser candidate. I don't think I've ever seen a close defenseman put up an 8 ground ball, 5 caused turnover game. That's an incredible stat line. So the Big Red beat their rivals, secure the number 2 seed in the Ivy League tournament, and will take on Yale on Friday.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is, to toot my own horn for a second, I think this is exactly representative of a young, energetic, excited player like Connor Buzik, who has full reign of a team. You know, it's like, because their last 2 games before this was a bad loss to Army. Who'd they lose to last week?
Yes. Cornell. Oh, wait, you're talking about Cornell losing to Army?
Army, and then they lost to Brown. So yeah. They have 2 back-to-back losses. The Army loss was bad. The Brown loss was bad. And I think that, like, especially going into, like, an Ivy League tournament, it's always in the player's mind. It's always in the coach's mind that the coach speak is, oh, we don't really, you know, we want to finish out strong, this and that. But players generally have this proclivity to be like, oh shit, if we're sliding on a downhill trajectory, it's very easy to get that downward momentum, like, consistent and to underperform. And I think it's more difficult than a lot of other people realize to right the ship. Even if you have talent, even if you have, you know, quote unquote, senior leadership, I think a lot of that kind of comes from the top down. So to see Cornell go out and get a big win over Princeton and then have a little bit of momentum going into Yale for the Ivy League tournament is representative of a guy like Connor Buzik, who has this, you know, experience knowing how locker rooms work and getting his players back on track, you know, performing at an unbelievably high level after two bad losses, I think is a testament to him. And more importantly, backs up what I'm saying about how coaches need to be younger.
No ulterior motive there.
No ulterior motive. Not even for me, though.
Well, yeah, no, I know. You're out of that game. You're just advocating for your boys.
Yeah. How bad was Princeton B, though? I mean, I know that, I don't know. This is another talking point where it's just like, I don't get the Ivy League sometimes because they're nasty. And I'm like, oh shit, Princeton is what, number two in the RPI, and their defense kind of has come out and in the last couple games, like, kind of taken a dump on the field. Like, what, how much have they regressed and how big of a red flag is it?
Okay. So right now, oh, come on. Sorry. Just clicked away from where I wanted to be. Right now, Princeton's defense is 48th. In adjusted efficiency.
Holy moly.
They were like 10th, like two or three games ago. Now, that being said, I am using two different methods to determine this number. Basically, Lax Reference doesn't incorporate riding and clearing. Patrick McEwen's does. So they were 7th in adjusted efficiency 2 games ago. In Patrick's method, and now they're 48th in adjusted efficiency according to Lax Reference. They gave up goals to Cornell on 42.1% of possessions, which is not great, Bob. Meanwhile, they held
not great,
the very good Boston University Terriers to scoring on just 14.4% of their possessions in that meeting, which was less than a month ago. So, yeah, I mean, they haven't played as well. It's really interesting because I think that in most people's estimation, they'd be a group who right now the whole is not playing as well as the parts. George Bond, obviously, I think has the eminent or preeminent reputation. But I think Pace Billings, who is from Colorado and I know you're familiar with, has played really well at points over the course of this season. Andrew Song, the LSM, was really good to start the year. Who am I blanking on? I know that Colin Molshine's insertion into the starting lineup has been one of the, you know, stabilizing factors. And then Ben Finley is another guy who got midseason All-America love, and goalie Eric Peters has been really highly regarded as well. And I tweeted about Bo Peterson last week because he just ragdolls people, which, by the way, we're going to have to talk about Peyton Rezonka, San Diego natives, addition into the ragdoll top five club.
But yeah, wow.
Did you see some of those?
Yes. I loved every second of it.
Talk about setting the tone against a team with a faceoff guy whose shorts are very short. I believe the first two times he got dodged, just threw the guy out of the club to steal it from Robin Gronkowski. But yeah, no, Princeton's defense definitely hasn't played as well in losses to Harvard and Cornell, in which they gave up an average of 18.5 goals over the course of the last 9 days.
Yeah, I mean, well, first off, let's, you know, Pace Billings is from Kent, Denver, which is like the opposite of Wheat Ridge. So yeah, he's doing good, but he could be doing better. I think he needs to be a little grittier. And then I don't know, Terry, I'm still upset about the entire Ivy League being good. So Are we officially moving on?
No, let me just quickly summarize by saying that we got to shout out Chris Yastrzemski for apparently keeping the league office in account or to holding them to account, because originally when the league tweeted their tiebreaker scenarios, they had the outcomes one way. And basically it was that if Cornell beat Princeton and Brown beat Dartmouth, which, you know, those games were at noon and then one, and then Harvard Yale's at two. If those outcomes unfolded, then both Harvard and Yale would be in the tournament and would only be a function of who was going to be seeded third and who was going to be seeded fourth. That was the original, you know, kind of put out into the world outcome scenario. Well, it come to find out that if Yale beat Harvard, that in fact the Crimson would miss the tournament and Penn would get the four seed. Now, obviously, that's what unfolded. In addition to that becoming clear, Penn also beat Albany 19-11 on Saturday and survived an overtime scare against St. Joe's on Tuesday that you've probably got something to say about.
No. Maybe.
You don't know a midfielder for the Hawks who had the ball in his stick in overtime?
Yeah, well, here's the deal, Terry. You know, what are we going to reward failure? You know, you have an infinity goal lead against Penn. All you have to do is close them out. You can't do that. And then, you know, anytime you have the ball outside of your stick, yes. And by the way, we're talking about Colin Reich. We call him intern Coolin, and sometimes we call him, hey, who's that kid in the corner not talking to anyone? So, you know, a man of many nicknames. But I mean, think about the clout that you can have if you just go and score an OT winner and instead he passes it. And granted, it was a great shot and a potential game winning assist. But this was such another head scratcher because everybody was watching to like, oh, my God, if this happens, then Penn, you know, RPI and all that BS and all these, you know, made up algorithms that decide who gets into the playoffs. We just know that it would have been beneficial to Notre Dame and the ACC. So we were grilling him in the group chat after an appropriate amount of time. But I love it because it's just an agent of chaos. And anytime there's chaos, it's, I think, objectively good. But goddamn, Penn, decide if you're good or bad. Decide if you can stave off a run or if you need to come back against St. Joe's in the fourth quarter. Decide if you're blowing out teams. But you can't just beat every team by one. That's not how this works. You have to lose one of those because now everyone thinks you're good. But if you dropped one or two of those games, then it's a completely different story. So Penn needs to figure it out. And yes, I love the chaos, but I hate that I don't know if they're good or not. And I hate that it doesn't benefit my own interests. And credit to me for being transparent.
Very much credit to you. We should add that Brown took care of business against Dartmouth, 15-6 winners in, I believe this game was in Hanover. Ryan Ogavin, four goals and an assist, and the Bears are the number one seed in the Ivy League tournament. Connor Terrio had eight saves and let in five goals. The people's goalie is going to be on display. They're going to take on the Penn Quakers in what could potentially be another one-goal game.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a one-goal game. I have, you know, when this season started, I kind of wanted to give, like, quote-unquote unique takes and, like, other insight. This game, Brown's going to jump out to a lead, Penn's going to come back, and Brown's going to win in overtime. Like, it's just that simple.
Well said. That is a very unique take.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Awesome. The writing for this season is getting boring, so I'm going to get ahead of that and call that as what's going to happen.
All right. Teased it a little bit ago, but the Fighting Irish's domination over Syracuse continued on Sunday afternoon as the bubble Notre Dame squad went into the Carrier Dome and beat Syracuse 18-11. Pat Kavanaugh, four goals and five assists. Chris Kavanaugh, 2-2. Eric Dobson, three goals and an assist. Liam Entenmann, 22 saves Will Lynch, 12 of 27 facing off. Jacob Flop had a good day. Both guys got three violation penalties in the first half. Nick Acello, go off, King.
I would just like to address Syracuse.
Okay, so are you going to start by talking about your prediction that they were going to make it to the Final Four?
No.
Okay.
That prediction was brought to you by Make a Wish. So that was kind of like a little free handout. And I was like, all I did is I just put that prediction right on the table. And I said, hey, I'm going to head out to go, you know, play men's league lacrosse, which I did earlier today. Please don't ruin that prediction and embarrass me. You don't have to make the Final Four. Just don't embarrass me. This is an embarrassment. Notre Dame is the full landlord. Syracuse is Notre Dame's property. In the last four games, Notre Dame has scored 80 goals. Syracuse has scored 36 goals. There is not a bigger discrepancy or disparity between two programs right now. Notre Dame trending upwards into, you know, pretty much into the upper echelon of lacrosse. We started out a little slow and we say, hey, we actually belong. Meanwhile, Syracuse just got flushed down the toilet and is swimming with all the other dumps that everybody in the world has taken. And honestly, Terry, the thing is we schedule them twice pretty much to say, hey, let's just keep this tradition going. But at this point, you can only schedule one tune-up game. That is Syracuse for us. We should not schedule them twice because this is such an embarrassment to Notre Dame's scheduling and an embarrassment to this entire organization that we play Syracuse twice.
You know, the team was back in South Bend at like 5:45 p.m.
Yeah, they chartered because it's finals week.
It's incredible. So, talk about the game.
I would like to make a distinction because one of the biggest worries that I've had about Notre Dame's program in the last couple of years was the departure of Jerry Byrne. And I think what Notre Dame does a really good job of defensively, and I've called it out, and they seem to be growing and evolving with every single game, is giving up two things. One, shots that Liam Entman can save. And I think there's kind of like this, Liam Entman is good. I don't think anyone's going to argue that. I think a lot of that credit goes to the defense being strategic about what they're giving up, in stark contrast to Coach Byrne, who was so system first. And the second is, I think they just do a really good job of making the Syracuse players like uncomfortable. It's like, hey, if you're a right-handed player, you know, of course you're going to be trying to get to your right hand, but if you split down, you know, you go right to left, split down the alley, that feed to the back pipe, God forbid a throwback, those are extremely hard passes for, you know, players that haven't developed really good two hands. They're hard passes for anyone to make. So I think Notre Dame is almost taking the opposite approach of like, we are going to force these players into uncomfortable situations. And I also think that Liam Entman has worked with this defense enough to be like, hey, man, give up that shot. Don't give up that shot. And I think that you've seen a progression, and it's why Notre Dame is hot, because this unit has been growing. And conversely, I mean, I can't recall a time when I saw worse collective communication, you know, from an ACC school than Syracuse today. Pat Kavanaugh has a short stick. You know, it was the clip that unfortunately went viral. Unfortunate for that short stick D-Mitty, because what you're trying to do is force a rollback. And there
this is the one that
there.
You talked about tabletopping yourself on?
Yeah, because the Kavanaughs are such a nightmare. Like, I even remember one of the first times I tried to guard Cav, Matt Kavanaugh. I can't even say Cav anymore. Right. But anytime you go to initiate contact, the way that they change direction is, yes, it's quick, but they get so low to the ground that you overextend yourself and either tabletop yourselves over their low body, or your cross check is out beyond your toes and you've already forfeited your athleticism trying to initiate that contact. Matt Kavanaugh, I think, is kind of the king of that. I think there are other guys, you know, I think Joey Sankey does a really good job of it. I think there are some other, you know, I think Jordan Wolf's rollback was mostly quickness, but he also had that low center of gravity. Pat Kavanaugh is doing it as good, if not better, than Matt. And how was that a surprise? How was an inside roll from Pat Kavanaugh a surprise and nobody was even thinking about a slide. I just think that play, while yes, it's unfortunate, I can't remember who the short stick D-Mitty was. We all end up on a highlight reel, shake it off, grab a beer, grab a Dr. Pepper, hit the showers. The fact that they weren't ready for a slide is representative of how discombobulated and quiet this defense is.
And not only that, but there was an incredible example of the opposite where Nick Acamo, who, you know, there was a really dramatic highlight because we're talking about a very similar scenario to the game-winning goal that Cornell scored in the Carrier Dome against the Orange when just prior to that, we were in the Syracuse defensive huddle hearing Dave Petromela say, if you're going to slide, slide. If you're going to stay, stay. Don't get caught in between. And then immediately that's what happened. And it happened again today. And it was a situation where it was like, you're sliding to – he was the second slide. And he slid to the crease. He didn't slide to cover somebody on the crease. And as a result, just kept open. I mean, you talked about skip passes and how as you graduate in levels, they become more dangerous because the skill level of the players, both throwing and catching, increases so dramatically that something that wasn't a threat at high school is in college, and something that wasn't a threat in college is in the pros. I mean, this is a threat. It was a 10-yard pass. But it's the exact opposite of what you just described, which is not going when you should go and going when there's no reason to go and you can't leave the guy that you're leaving.
Yeah. And then not deciding either. And then now you're not applying ball pressure, making that pass hard, and you're leaving your guy open. No man's land. My least favorite part about high school lacrosse is that you overhedge and you underslide. And I think that's interesting that I always think about that from high school because it was hammered into me so quickly at college that that's not something that you do. That if I'm Petro or if I'm the defensive coordinator at a program that's struggling with that, I'm literally breaking sticks in the locker room and like slamming it against the wall going like, guys, I don't know what we have to do, but whatever we do as a defense – doesn't work if we get caught in no man's land and if you don't listen to me. Like, slide, don't slide. We can live with these decisions. What we can't live with is indecisions. And for that to happen this late, I mean, be do, red flag, mayday, mayday. So, you know, I don't know if it's a player. I don't know if it's a coach thing. I don't know what the dynamics are, but that's something that needs to be nipped in the bud starting the very first practice, the very first team workout come August on, you know, in the Carrier Dome, first practice.
So on the Irish side, I mean, you talked about the defense, but you got to be excited about this offense too.
Yeah. You know, I think that I put a big premium on offenses that have kind of like unique threat dynamics. You know, a guy like Dobson who can step down, a guy like Taylor who has really good inside finishing skills. You know, the Kavanaughs, I think, speak for themselves. But, you know, the second line middies right now are really what has me optimistic and just ready to get my heart ripped out come playoffs. But the fact that depth, from what I'm seeing today, and granted we were playing, you know, one of the worst programs in the history of the sport. Chirp.
Yeah, I heard
the
it.
The depth on Notre Dame does not seem to be a problem. Like you look at the, you know, of course you have the Dobsons, the Myers, the Jacobices, and then everyone else that's stepping on the field seemingly is a threat. And I think that in years past, like, you know, when I was a sophomore and I would get like, you know, my errant run as an offensive midfielder, I think a lot of times it was like, I'm a threat to dodge, but I'm not shooting and I don't have the vision and I don't have anything to really be a threat. It seems like the depth of threats from Notre Dame is, you know, not Maryland level, but really, really good and better than I've seen it in quite a long time, particularly from the midfield. Notre Dame generally has good attack. And, you know, the second line middies kind of need to rely on the attack. Right now, it's just looking like a team that's firing on all cylinders.
Yeah. Riley Gray had a good day. He had two goals. Will Angrick had a goal. Looked like he was dangerous in other instances as well. David Lipka had a goal. I mean, 11 guys scored for Notre Dame. So you got to be optimistic about that. We are at roughly the 12-minute mark of the third quarter, and Duke just went ahead 8-7 on a Sean Lully lefty alley dodge where he put it far side off hip. Well, actually, it's stick side hip on Colin Krieg. Yeah, I guess he's a lefty. So we will keep you apprised of that. It is the other very important outcome that we could be talking about in this podcast. But as we move along, some craziness in the SoCon. Mercer 14, High Point 11, and VMI had Richmond on the ropes late before the Spiders won 14-12. It sets up a SoCon tournament that it didn't change anything. So High Point finished third in the SoCon standings, so they were already going to play Richmond as the 2-3, and then Jacksonville was the 1 seed, and Mercer had already clinched the 4 seed. So that Mercer-High Point game didn't have a material effect on things, but is definitely unexpected as far as results are concerned, and particularly given that you and I have spent a fair amount of time talking about this conference over the course of the year, and I touted Richmond and High Point relative to Jacksonville at the end of last week's podcast. There's a little bit of egg on my face.
Yeah. Boy, and let me tell you, everyone that I've ever met was texting me how stupid you look. starting off with Mercer High Point, like just before this episode, I was like, so here's who Mercer has lost to: Bucknell, Navy, Jacksonville, Robert Morris, Wagner Air Force, Utah, VMI, Richmond, Jacksonville. Yeah, I repeated some. Shut up. Go call your mom.
No, you didn't. They lost twice to Jacksonville.
Yeah, I said I repeated some.
Yeah, because they lost to them twice.
Yeah.
You said okay. Their name twice because they lost to them twice. Yeah.
Semantics. Yeah. Anyways, so going back to how you sounded so stupid last week. No. Is this the biggest upset of the season?
It's crazy that you say that because when we were talking about
it. Seems like it
to me. Yeah, it's pretty close. VMI beating Richmond would have clearly been the biggest upset of the season.
Not even close.
This probably was. And I think it, you know, puts into question what's been going on with the Panthers over the course of the last three halves, because they played Richmond tight for the first half, and then I think they lost 9-0 in the second half. Got to right the ship. Asher Nolting's going to get back to the NCAA tournament. There's a lot of work to do in the wooden furniture capital of the United States.
Is that actually a thing?
Oh, yeah. Big time.
Oh, that's awesome. Also, I got to give major shout out to VMI because they are a team that anytime I see a box score, anytime I see a score that includes VMI, I'm assuming it's double-digit losses. And while I'm not here to talk about how they're a good team, I am here to talk about how these games, it's like anytime you're kind of the whipping boy of anything, it's like, all right, you kind of just hope that they have some sort of thing to tip their cap on. You know, and just looking at like VMI beat Mercer, which blows my mind. Because I'm still stuck in that in 2015, they were just, quite frankly, not a good team.
And I actually think I need to clean that up, because I think that Mercer might not have made the SoCon tournament had they not beaten High Point. They might have been playing for their lives. And then VMI also was doing the same thing. No, against High Point yesterday, because they had lost to VMI. So I might have had
Yeah, they were playing for their lives in the tournament bid that VMI would have gotten.
Yes.
Oh, that's wow.
Because now there's a three-way tie of teams that finish 2 and 3, and then Mercer and High Point get in. VMI is the team that gets left out.
Yeah. I mean, bummer for them, but this is something that like those seniors can kind of tip their cap to and be like, hey guys, you know, this season we got a couple wins, we beat Mercer, and remember how close we played Richmond. Like, that is something that can be I talk about momentum a lot, but like, I really think there's a difference in momentum of like Notre Dame getting ready for, you know, whatever game against UNC and VMI and some of these lesser programs. And I don't say that like disparagingly, but when you're a military academy that charges tuition, the cards are stacked in your favor. And for those kids to tough it out, like those seniors are going to be talking about that Richmond game for so long. And I honestly don't know how many of those moments, you know, teams like VMI get a year. So anytime I see something like this, I get irrationally excited about a team losing by two goals. But I do think that like years from now at some reunion when it's 2060 and a bunch of old farts from VMI are standing around a keg, they get to talk about how they were the ones that almost took it to Richmond and, you know, inflate the story tenfold. So props to VMI. The cards are stacked in your favor. You've scraped together a pretty impressive 4-10 season and a marquee loss that is sneaky, a big win for the program. And now I'm not going to say anything nice.
Taking it all the way back to Friday, a pair of overtime outcomes in the Patriot League determine the seeding order as well as the quarterfinal matchups. Loyola 13, Lehigh 12. This was a game that the Greyhounds jumped out to and really lead to. We already talked about Peyton Rzonka's performance. Bailey Savio, the faceoff guy for Loyola, handed Michael Sisselberger his second straight rough outing as he won 17-28 and picked up 8 ground balls, added a goal to his ledger. And Kevin Cassis said postgame that they just need to figure it out. He talked about how earlier in the week he needed to get Sisselberger to move past the rough outing that he had against BU. And now they're going to have to do the same thing because, you know, it's a quick turnaround for the Mountain Hawks who are in the quarterfinals and playing on Tuesday. Kevin Lindley had the overtime game winner. Aiden Olmstead have finished with 4 goals and assist. And Davis Lindsay, who missed last week's game due to a non-COVID illness, was back in the lineup and put up a goal and 4 assists. And then as soon as that game ended, BU Army got underway. And that was an incredible affair that the Black Knights won in regulation 15-14 in a game that really kind of, in my opinion, came down to a pivotal timeout that Joe Alberici called after BU scored to cut Army's lead to 14-13. Connor Calderon won the faceoff forward against Will Coletti, but there was a timeout called before the faceoff. So they came back out, refaced. Coletti won, scored, put him up 15-13, and then the Terriers scored with like 1 second left or as time expired to make it 15-14. Usually you see timeouts go the other way. Like, for instance, we saw one in Notre Dame Syracuse where a Kevin Corrigan timeout took a Notre Dame goal off the board. This was a very well-timed timeout. So shout out to the coaching staff for that one.
I might sound like a jerk, just getting ahead of that right now. So when Loyola plays Lehigh and when Army plays Boston, I don't see any of these teams, like, we're so late into the season where it's like, okay, don't really see any of those four teams making a push to win a national championship, focusing only on the playoffs. I don't think that, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, the outcome of these games generally impacts the playoff seeding. Am I correct in that assessment?
Yeah. I mean, it affects the conference tournament seedings, which obviously have a direct...
Or not seedings, but entrance. Like, it doesn't affect the bubble, really, right?
Correct.
Why do I care about these two games?
Because they're exciting.
Outside of... Yeah. Okay, perfect. Okay, now that we got that out of the way, I hope that Sisselberger stays at Lehigh for 5 more years, because there is nothing funnier than watching a guy whose skin tone matches his shorts, who has an absolute Tonka dump truck, stay in a 45-second face-off. It was like, it was pure comedy, and I went on Twitter and was like, ban everybody who's ever taken a face-off. I will allow it if he goes one size shorter on his shorts next year, and if he can give me 1 minute face-off tie-ups. It was, they needed to play that song, that circus song, like that, because I was like, what am I usually
do that?
Right?
you usually do that song over a bunch of like chaotic things that are happening. You don't just typically do it where still. Nothing is happening. Yeah, it's just two guys just like hanging out.
Yeah, just go. And I remember pretty early on, Liam O'Connor was the face-off guy above me. And he was like super dedicated to his craft. You know, he would always try to get extra reps after practice. And I'm like, yeah, face-offs kind of suck. I guess I'll just do them, but I'm not doing anything extra. And I remember I actually distinctly remember this because I was a sophomore at the time. And you're not going to believe it, but I was pretty cocky in college. Shocker. And he was giving me like tactics and advice on what to do if you're like tied up for more than, you know, 5 seconds.
Okay.
It sounds like my ex-wife, but you know, if you're just like sitting there in a stalemate, that could never ever happen to me. Cause after about 2 seconds, I'm like, okay, I'm going to throw a counter because this is literally boring. The dumbest thing that can happen in lacrosse.
I was going to ask how you felt about it. I don't have to. You preemptively provided your opinion. I'm shocked by that.
Unless it's Sisselberger with the skin colored shorts.
Can you even explain why it happens or how it happens?
It's like it's two
was
guys
the ball under one. It was the ball in the, I don't know, the back of the throat of one guy's stick in that moment.
No, it's almost, you know, too simple to explain. Where it's like both of the throats are touching over the ball at the same time.
Got it.
And
so it's like the ball is in half the ball is in each guy's stick.
Yeah, and guys are getting so strong right now that like I don't care what head you have. It's just like it's a battle of how flimsy these heads are. So both guys are like pushing it into that stalemate even more so.
Got it.
And it just becomes stupid.
Nick, Duke is now up 12-7 with I think about 6 minutes to go. I keep giving these updates right after goals are scored and the clock isn't on the screen anymore. But Andrew McAdory just swept across the top of the North Carolina defensive box, went to his right, and a low bouncer from, I don't know, like 11 yards out. Beacon Krieg low and away. That was an exceptional shot and a really nice fist pump celebration. There is 6 minutes and 14 seconds to go. I don't think we're going to get a 5-goal comeback from the Tar Heels here. They just called timeout. They're a little bit on the ropes. This game's at Koskinen. Should have ended almost an hour ago. I think we're going to have to cut this edition of the Tailgate Podcast and hopefully Carolina doesn't come back. Otherwise, we're going to sound like idiots.
Yeah, no. Let's call it unless Chris Gray gets some support. You know, it's like best supporting cast, but the opposite for UNC this year.
I'm pretty sure it's just best actor.
Yeah, he's best actor. And what the Razzies, the Razzie for best supporting actor goes to all of UNC's offense that's not Chris Gray. Isn't that like the bad one?
Yes. Nailed it.
Ha, good. Good job, Nick.
He's got 4 final points. Question for you. He needed 6 in order to set the all-time scoring record. So I'm going to stop talking to you and pay attention to that.
We already have something. It's going to be released tomorrow, but if he breaks the record, we're going to post a congratulations to Chris Gray, and it's going to be a picture of Billy Bitter. So we're pretty excited about that. Final question for you, Terry.
Yes.
Is there a better celebration than the pimp the stick throw to Mars like we saw in Yale Harbor?
I mean, what did you think of Ryder's dead fish celebration? Because that seems like the only thing that was more universally liked, and I'm with you. Like, for me, it didn't do anything. I think that the answer to your question is no. Throwing your stick as high and far as possible, turning it into a projectile that could injure somebody, is far and away the best celebration.
You know who has the worst stick throw celebration of all time?
You?
No, well, maybe. I don't usually score the last goal of a game anywhere.
Sure.
Unless it's like scrub minutes, and then it's like that's mine for the keeping. Sergio Perkovic scoring in overtime against Virginia. He like goes to throw his stick up, and it goes like parallel with the ground, like 7 feet away from him. It's one of my favorite stick throws ever. So maybe I go and try and dig up that clip.
All right, Nick, as always, it was a pleasure, and we'll talk to you next week. We're going to know. Actually, I don't know whether we're going to talk next week, because typically I talk to the coaches and the teams that got snubbed on Selection Sunday. Maybe we'll have to do a special. Yeah, we're going to have to figure this out.
Maybe I join and provide comedic relief.
There you go. We get you talking to, I don't know, who's going to be the most upset? Well, Jerry Byrne.
Oh, God, no. Oh, my God, no.
All right, that'll do it for this edition of the Tailgate. Appreciate everybody for listening. Love you, Nick.
Love you. Oh, yeah.
Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the Tailgate.